The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
Hi there, podcast fans. I'm Tom Gibbs. Welcome to Telegraph Audio Football Club. Arsenal are your FA Cup 2020 champions after a mildly thrilling 2-1 victory in front of 90,000 empty seats at Wembley Stadium. Will this be the making of Mikel Arteta and his team? Can they hang on to Aubameyang? And why Frank Lampard choosing to build from the front explains some of Chelsea's problems in defence. We'll reflect on the departure of Eddie Howe from Bournemouth, where we foresee looming clouds in the not-too-distant future, preview the Championship playoff final, and take a look around the burgeoning summer transfer market. Plus, the Champions League, its half-brother Europa, goings-on from Serie A, and the clumsiest footballer moments ever. Let's take you now into a series of remote audio recording facilities where I'm joined, first of all, by Mina Rizuki. How are you, Mina?
Oh, I'm good. How are you?
Yeah.
You don't start with me regularly.
No, you've got to mix it up. I reckon if you went back through all the episodes, I've rotated the person I come to first pretty evenly. Do you agree with that, Matt Law?
I do agree. I'm never sure. You keep me on my toes when you start the intros. I like it.
Exactly. You want to be alert, ready to hear your name and ready to say something funny. JJ Ball, fulfill your destiny.
Yes. And also, another thing I noticed that you do is that when one of us hasn't talked for a while, you ask us the next question to make sure everyone is involved.
That is true.
This is what hosting is all about, JJ.
Yes.
I'm forever marking it off as a series of 5-bar gates and making sure everyone gets an equal opportunity to talk. But let's talk first of all about the FA Cup final, and whoever out of you can answer this. Chelsea on top to begin with, it seemed like it had all the makings of a gutless thrashing for Arsenal, but they got control of the game. Do you think they deserved to win it in the end?
I think they did, yeah. And Lampard kind of summed it up. He thinks his players were a little bit complacent during the game, but I've written an analysis of this game this morning that I haven't watched it. From the entire game changes during the first water break, when Arteta gets the players all around him and just starts being, he's very animated and he's slapping his hand into his other hand and like, you must do this, do this. And all he did was change, was make sure that rather than pass sideways, always looking for the short ball, they're going for the long option. And it's something he's been doing from the very start since he came into Arsenal. There's a training session where you can see he's explaining what pass he wants. He wants to hit the furthest man forward and then move from there rather than playing it always like progressing it through lines slowly because it takes too long. And as soon as they went back onto the pitch, Kieran Tierney was last to go back on. He was double-checking everything with Arteta. You could see him asking, what do you want here and there? First thing Tierney does is hurl the ball up the line from the throw-in. Tierney then plays a series of long balls over the tops. Not long balls that makes it sound like it's a bad pass, but they're just utilising the space. Because before they were told to knock the ball long over the top towards Lacazette and Aubameyang, Chelsea's wing-backs were pushed really high up and they were pressing them close. So like Rob Holding would always hit it short to Bellerin and then Bellerin have to make a little pass inside and Chelsea moved up, kind of pincered them and won the ball back again and again and again. As soon as they started knocking it long, the wing-backs couldn't push up as high because there was too much space behind them to come back and Arsenal were able to get into it that way. And I mean, the goals, one was a penalty, obviously, that Azpilicueta got caught the wrong side of him. That can happen. And the second goal was a result of Rudiger rushing out and missing his tackle and Bellerin, which then put Christensen in a little bit of bother. He dived into a tackle, which he didn't win. I think Zuma might have won that had he been the central defender, but Zuma wasn't the central defender because Azpilicueta got off injured. A lot of things went wrong for Lampard. Now, he didn't get anything wrong, but I think the way Arteta drilled into his players what he must have been coaching them on all week before this game is what won in the game, and they were decent.
Did he not fail to respond slightly to that change in tactics, Mina, when Arsenal did go longer? Did Lampard, do you think, did he read that well enough and did he fail to cope with that?
I think he failed to cope with that, but I think there's also, I think on a defensive level, this isn't a team that's really, I mean, we've already noticed all the mistakes that they've made at the back. And it seems to be, you know, it was a simple sort of ball on top. They did try to adjust in the second half, but then the space became in front of them rather than behind, you know, where Azpilicueta was, in those spaces in the corners, just became a little bit more in front of them. And there were just wide gaps a lot lot from Lampard's team. But I do think I'm just a big believer in psychology, and sometimes I do think that, you know, your team can come back and notice problems or whatever it is, you can address that and you can come back bigger and better. But I think what happened is it's like exactly after that drinks break, things just started going wrong with Chelsea. And this is also a problem that you'll get with youth a lot of the times, is that their head will drop. You know, they eventually, like, everything started going wrong. They lost their leader. Then they lost Kovacic to a red card, a second yellow card. And I think then it becomes sometimes really hard to pick yourself up, especially when the defense on a lot of the times is on one-on-ones. I did have an issue with Zuma in his defending, in the sense that I thought that Rio Ferdinand just came across that so well. There is an issue when it comes to pivoting sometimes when you watch the Premier League. I feel like a lot of the players there, it's not that easy to just pivot. So the positioning is always that difficult to change, and a lot of them get caught flat-footed. You see that quite a lot. And I thought that that was, and when Rio Ferdinand spoke about it with Zuma, I was like, oh my God, that's just exactly what it is. But yeah, that's it.
Yeah, Zuma certainly did let him pass fairly easily for that admittedly brilliant goal. Arteta afterwards seemed fairly confident that Aubameyang will stay at Arsenal. Do you think he will, Matt?
I think he probably will. I'm not actually, this sounds mad, I'm not actually sure there's a move out there for him at the moment. A year or so ago, and in very different times, there probably was quite a few options out there, but I'm not convinced there's the move that would tempt Aubameyang to necessarily give up what he's got at Arsenal. I mean, he's captain. He's clearly the sort of the star man. I think as long as they pay him what he wants, he probably will stay now on the balance of things. And, you know, 6 months ago, I'd have thought he was definitely going to leave. I mean, funnily enough, I thought for a while that Man City should sign him. I mean, you get no comeback value on him whatsoever. You're signing him probably, you're paying 30-odd million in his wages for 2 or 3 years, and you're never going to get any money back. But given Aguero's getting older and injury problems and what a guarantee Aubameyang is, I'd go out and get him if I was City. But I think he'll probably stay now, yeah.
Also, because he just has that know-how, right? Like, just how he like gets Azpilicueta on the floor, just how he uses his body. He's got, like, there's that intelligence that you've got over your players. And I just feel like for a team like City, that would be so useful for them to have, you know, somebody going forward. I know that, you know, that's not exactly maybe what they're looking for. But I don't know.
I think he'd give them something different. I think he'd be a really good option for them. And he is just a guarantee. He's an absolute guarantee of goals as well.
Yeah, yeah. Pace and like all, exactly that. I don't know why sometimes I feel like they go for same, whereas I really think that he would add another flavour and would be so useful against especially certain opponents.
Yeah, let's not harsh Arsenal's buzz too much. A wonderful day for them as a club. Big moment in the career of Mikel Arteta, and potentially feels like a big moment for this group of players. It's not the first time Arsenal won the cup in recent history, and they've failed to kick on a little bit in the past. Could this be the time when they finally do take one of these FA Cup wins and really build from it?
I think they've got the right manager too, which they haven't for a while. I mean, in the latter days of Wenger, he was winning the FA Cup a lot, but it was clear that things had just got so sort of toxic with the fans and everything that he was never going to, at that stage, lead them forward. And then, obviously, since him, they've gone through a couple of managers. I think they've got the right manager. I'm still reluctant to say this is going to be the start of amazing things for Arsenal, just because if you were confident they had the finances to do what Arteta probably wants to do in the summer, I'd be extremely optimistic for them. But I'm not confident they're going to spend the money. I'm just not confident that the ownership will give him what he needs, and therefore, it's difficult to know. It's going to be really interesting as to how heavily they back him, because you get the feeling, were he to be backed, that he looks like he knows the direction to take that team and squad, and that he would get them really making a lot of progress. But I'm not confident they will.
What about on the Chelsea side? The problem for them all year seems to have been fairly clear. It's at the back, and yet that's not the area they seem to be strengthening in the transfer market. Is there a sense sometimes that managers can change defenders, that you can coach a good defence out of what you've already got, but you can't really do that with attacking players? You've got to strengthen those areas and get the good players while they're available. Is there the makings of a decent defence at Chelsea, or do they need to sign some players?
It's funny, isn't it? Because traditionally, we've been used to the top teams traditionally of almost building from the back. You know, Arsenal, George Graham did it. To a certain extent, Man United did it under Fergie. It used to be that you'd say, oh, you have to build from the back. You have to get your goalkeeper, you have to get your defenders, and then you can have around that. Lampard actually has made a good point in the last few weeks in that City and Liverpool did it the other way around, and it looks like he's doing it the other way around. I don't really know why. I don't know why the trend has changed, and whether it's just to do with how we like to watch our football now. But he made the point in the first year that City under Guardiola conceded an awful lot of goals and hadn't got their defence anywhere near right. And obviously, Klopp at Liverpool, it took a few years till they got Van Dijk. So he seems to be going that route. He seems to want to get his style and philosophy enforced through doing it through the attacking players and then trying to work out the defence afterwards. It seems to be back to front to me. But
well, I think the idea is that you you defend by keeping the ball as far away from your own goal as possible. And Lampard seems really attacking and he wants his players to press quite high. They play such a high line and they often leave just one player on his own on the halfway line in the centre circle. It's the kind of thing you don't really see on TV, but when you watch them live, so many players go forward. Often Kovacic is the deepest and the centre-backs push forward to like a midfield position. And I think by having a really strong attack, it means that other teams have to play in a different way against them. So if you're really scared of how good Chelsea are going forward, you're naturally going to probably sit deeper back, which means that Chelsea are going to have more possession and they've got the players to be able to do that. The thing with if your centre-backs make mistakes, if you're planning on getting the strongest centre-backs you can, then maybe the problem you've got is that they're having to react to situations and certain centre-backs will be better than others in those situations. But that can be something that you can coach the team as a unit. You should defend as a unit, not as individual players. So even though like Zuma got turned by Aubameyang in that one instance, I mean, he might develop into a great defender, Zuma. Like I think he's decent now already. I think Rudiger's a good defender on his own. I think Azpilicueta has been one of the best defenders in the league this season. And these players are not poor, but the individuals that you can sign to improve defence cost so much. And Chelsea definitely already needed to stack their forward line to become more potent going forward, especially like Matt's saying, to do with how Lampard wants to play. Like if they're exciting going forward and attacking, it changes how the opposition approach to them. And it also means that they can defend by continually attacking.
Sorry, I know that I sort of like went on about Zuma and being flat-footed, but I do not, yeah, exactly. I think he is a very good defender, and I think obviously Azpilicueta is too. But what I think that they do lack at the back, again, is somebody who just speaks up. I do think that they need somebody who is, you know, who's going to shout, who's going to yell. A lot of the times, if you see like back, if we look in Europe, for example, Real Madrid always had, you know, a gung-ho attack. And a lot of the time, what they would have is someone like Fabio Cannavaro at the back, obviously Sergio Ramos, and they would communicate. So they'd say, Marcelo, you know, you go ahead, you can have the time of your life on that left wing, and you know, push up as far as you like. But when I yell, you better get back into place as soon as possible. And they could afford that because they had really young, pacey fullbacks. And that's what Chelsea want. They have a young team. So you need to have somebody who has the authority at the back to take control, I think, a lot of the time. I don't think there's enough communication going on there. I always think that it's not about buying the best defenders, but about having a good sort of midfield and a good defense. If you see the way that Arsenal conceded that goal against Pulisic, what were the midfield exactly doing? Sometimes you'll see that with Juventus, who attack so well, it's not because Bonucci and Chiellini are so great. A lot of the time it was because Khedira would drop back into the fullback roles, or Matuidi will cover the left back. Mandzukic sometimes would drop back and become a left back. It's about covering spaces a lot of the time. But if you are playing a very gung-ho style of football, then it's important that your centre-backs are good on the one-on-one situations. I personally think so, but also just having somebody there at the back who knows how to yell and communicate, and everyone's willing to follow that.
That's a great point, because it's been really noticeable in the games with no fans of how quiet Chelsea are. They're really, really quiet. Azpilicueta talks up a little bit. Kepa, actually, when Kepa plays, shouts a lot in Spanish, but generally they're virtually silent. They're so, honestly, they're so quiet. Against every team I've seen them play since the restart, when I've seen them live, they've been quieter than their opposition, much quieter.
Time for JT 2.0, isn't it?
They've got to get someone. I mean, obviously football's changed a bit since then, but they need someone to direct them a bit. They really need someone to. And I thought that was lacking on Saturday, because you can say that Lampard didn't respond, but he actually needed a response from his players on the pitch, and particularly with Azpilicueta, who's probably the only outfield player who does shout a bit. They'd have been silent on that pitch on Saturday.
I'd say Azpilicueta is probably their only nasty player as well. Like, they'd have a lot of nice players. Kanté, who wins the ball, is really nice. He doesn't go in hard. Yeah. He goes and wins the ball. But Azpilicueta regularly kicks people, and I think you need a few.
They don't have any cynical players, do they?
Yeah.
They don't have any cynical. That's a better word. Chelsea used to have loads of.
Yeah. Once again, they need JT back. What we need to mention the refereeing as well. Chelsea will feel very hard done by about a couple of decisions, which was the worst of the refereeing flashpoints for you in this game.
The Kovacic second yellow, yeah, clearly. JJ put out a great tweet on the day with one of the still pictures where Saka's foot seemed to be on Kovacic's rather than the other way around.
I mean, well, that's the Richard Amorfa's tweet, to be clear.
Oh, was it? Sorry. Well, you retweeted it, and that's all that matters. Yeah. So the referee has been dreadful this season. I mean, VAR has been
fantastic. Are you going to make them look at every yellow card?
No. I mean, I do wonder whether part of it is the fact that they've become so emasculated by VAR, and their responsibility has been taken away so much, and they're so terrified of what might happen, and it's affected the standard refereeing. But it's been atrocious. I mean, I was watching the Championship a lot last season because Villa were in it, and the standard refereeing in the Championship is woeful. It's like watching Sunday League refereeing. And I really looked forward to a better standard of refereeing when Villa got up. And it's not been there. It's been the worst refereeing I've seen in ages. And I'm honestly not one for hammering refs usually. I usually get frustrated with managers who hammer refs, but I just think it's been useless.
Have you ever felt this is a good time for refereeing?
Well, but the flip side to that is that honestly, and you probably won't believe me, I so rarely talk about refereeing. I just ignore refereeing usually. I'm not that sympathetic to teams who moan about it or get bad decisions, but I just think this season it's been dreadful. There's been so many crap decisions.
Yeah, I do think VAR has spooked some of the officials. It's one of the many reasons why it's a scourge on our game. Let's leave the FA Cup final behind and talk about the departure of Eddie Howe from Bournemouth, left by mutual consent over the weekend. A little bit of a shock, just because he's one of those managers you can't really imagine not being in that job. But was this a good time for Bournemouth and Eddie Howe to go their separate ways, Mina?
I don't know if anything's ever a good time, but I just feel like this is somewhat of an end of a journey, because, you know, it is a relegation. I think that for him it was a shock. You could see throughout the whole season he just never imagined this was even a possibility. And I just feel like it's very hard to continue when you've dealt with a year of complete shock that you really thought you were building towards something. I'll be honest, I love Eddie Howe, and I think that what he has done is incredibly amazing. And I just feel like it's a huge loss for them, for Bournemouth as a club. I think that because he is not just really the coach, they were a team in deciding everything. They were a team about even deciding when we should really go for promotion at the time to the Premier League. You know, are we at the right stage? Should we do this? And you had a leader there who would be like, well, actually, I'd prefer if we have this in place so that we don't fall back down again. And it was just somebody who really, you always trusted. He loved the club and you always trusted him to make all the decisions. And he did. He made all the decisions. Whoever they take on afterwards now, as long as he's not going to be someone probably who's, you know, come and lived and done everything with the club from a very young age and had so much fan support that he's almost guaranteed his position. So it's going to be really tough for them to find somebody who shares that love for the club. And I don't even know if that's what they're looking for. But I think with him, despite how everyone, you know, and I am a fan, I do feel like with Bournemouth, though, it was a club that conceded so many goals every year. They were regularly the third or fourth worst team when it came to conceding goals, which always applied so much pressure to that front line. Eventually, the fairy tale was going to sort of fall apart unless you you had the world's greatest attack, basically. I feel like some teams can get away with it, obviously, like Manchester City not always having the world's greatest defense because they do have the world's greatest attack, basically. But I just feel like that was always going to stop, and he never really found a solution for it. And that's perhaps why I haven't always been so glowing in my reviews of Eddie Howe and his journey at Bournemouth.
So I've got an alternative view on Bournemouth and Eddie Howe. It's neatly forgotten that they had to pay a fine for breaking financial fair play in the year they got promoted to the Premier League. Every single promotion year, they had the highest wage bill in their division. He did a good job, but he did it with money. He did it with a lot of money. And now the club's in an absolutely terrible, terrible state. Their last set of accounts, their wage bill was 110.9 million. Their wage to turnover ratio, which everybody accepts should be at the highest, around 66%, otherwise you're in trouble, is 84.6%.
Is it really 84.6%?
84.6%. They're in a massive problem.
Sorry, yeah. It's just their that clubs, you never go over 68.
Their club's player registration costs were up from 55 million to 94. They had a loss of 32.4 million. They still owe, and this is what they owe on transfers from not last summer, the summer before, £80.1 million in unpaid transfer fees. So Ake going for 40 million has covered half of what they owed for two summers ago. They're in all kinds of problems. He's spent all the money and left. Whatever good job, he's done a really good job on lots of aspects. He's clearly a very good
coach. He's not the only one holding the cheque. There's other people who have obviously allowed him
But there's terrible mismanagement at Bournemouth that people just ignore. They have an office in Mayfair. Why do they have an office in Mayfair? It must cost them a bomb.
Yeah, that is weird. I know about that.
I didn't know that. That's great.
It's absolutely crazy. Absolutely crazy, the spending that's gone on there. And they're in trouble. They're in big trouble. And I'll tell you what their next appointment will be is cheap, because Eddie Howe is on over $4 million a year.
What about him?
I mean, he needs a break. He definitely needs a break. And I'm sure he'll get a good job afterwards. And he should get a good job. He's a good coach. But the next club he goes to needs to manage him differently from how Bournemouth have managed him. Because people talk about the Harry Redknapps of this world, about putting clubs in trouble on the spending. But you know, it's not that much different to what's gone on at Bournemouth. They've spent way beyond their means.
Yeah, we'll keep a close eye on them in the Championship. It does strike me as one of those where they might fall through that league fairly quickly. Alas, flew too close to the sun. Let's talk about the transfer window. We spoke a bit about Bournemouth sold Nathan Ake to City for $41 million. That seems like quite good business all round to me. It's a decent price for a good centre-back.
They wanted a left-footed centre-back. They've got Laporte, so if Laporte can't play, they can put him in. John Stones is, I think, being repurposed to use as something else. I don't know what they're going to do with him. Make him like a human table around the place. But Ake now...
mascot.
Yeah, something like that. He could be the mascot. That'd be good fun. I'd like to do that. Ake, decent player. I think I agree with Mina with a lot of the stuff she says about Man City here in the defending. I think they could do with someone who likes to header the ball and is just maybe a little bit more, I don't know what the word is, just bigger. Just a bigger lad. They need a bigger lad at the back. Obviously, they have all possession in almost every single game they have. So it makes sense they have players who can play with the ball. And Ake is really good at passing it, and he likes to carry the ball. You can play left back, you can play centre back. Suits exactly what Guardiola wants to do with him. But I would imagine that they won't be finished there. The rumour is that they want Koulibaly from Napoli as well, who would be that kind of like powerhouse at the back that can add a bit of steel there.
Yeah, I think Ake is a really smart signing. I mean, if you think that's half of what Man United paid for Harry Maguire, and he's definitely not half, he's a different type of defender, but he's definitely not half the player Harry Maguire is. As JJ pointed out, he can play left back, he can play in the back three, he can play defensive midfield.
Yeah.
He counts as homegrown in Europe because of coming through the Chelsea youth system, because they brought him over from Holland for so long. I think even if he's not a first team regular, I think at 40 million, he's a steal.
He's a steal, but I'm really worried that they are going to just start shoving him into lots of different places, because I think for his own personal progression, you know, consistency in a place is always much better than just having three or four different roles that you keep being put into. I don't know why. I just feel like players like that always end up being sort of a 7 out of 10 in a lot of things, but maybe not a 10 out of 10. And I think that he can eventually be like a really great player if he has a secure role and he plays with a little bit of consistency. But what I never get with them is that I do think that on this occasion, they do sort of need an older guy at the back. Just, I just, you know, like that was what sort of Kompany bought, right? Not the fact that he's old, but just that kind of, you know, somebody that you look up to. And I would have liked them to have gone for that, which would have been even cheaper. I do think Nathan Ake is a great deal for them, don't get me wrong. I don't think it should be Koulibaly, weirdly enough. Koulibaly is somebody who needs a very good partner alongside him as well. A lot of good defenders in this world that everyone points to need good partners, and he's one of them. And so I don't know who exactly is in you know, Manchester City that sort of possesses the sort of calm that he needs alongside him, because they bought him Manolas from Roma and it just didn't work out because Manolas is one of those, like, you know, tackle, slide, yeah, you know, like really going for it all the time. And I feel like he needs more like of an Albiol kind of guy before, which is when he did his best work, because then he could be that guy. But I do think that I would prefer them to go, I don't know, just like a cheap older head, just somebody who sort of tells them what to do, if that makes sense.
Just found out I'm older than Vincent Kompany, which has kind of bummed me out.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's depressing.
Yeah. In my head, he's definitely older than me because he's much cooler and more professional. I don't know. Oh, well. Mm-hmm. There we go.
Still, we're looking forward to your move into management in Belgium there, JJ. It'll be interesting to see what happens at Newcastle United takeover, seemingly dead in the water there now. Are they going to spend any money at all?
It'll depend. If Mike Ashley, if there isn't another takeover, then no, they won't. They'll spend barely any money because Mike Ashley's not going to spend a load of money just before he's trying to sell the club. It doesn't make any sense to. And he didn't spend a lot of money before when they weren't so close to a takeover. So I think they're very reliant on a takeover to spend. I mean, they'll spend some money. I, they'll have some money coming in from staying up in a decent season, but they're not going to spend any serious money. And if they don't have a takeover, I can see them being in trouble next season, because for the job that Steve Bruce did, which was great, whenever I watched them, they were regularly the worst team I saw. And they won or drew games that I don't know how they won or drew. I really don't. I mean, the one at Everton where they were 2-0 down and dead in the water and Bruce brings on a centre-back and he managed to score twice. I mean, some crazy stuff happened, and I do think Bruce did a ridiculously good job, but I also think they got lucky too. And I think Bruce will know that, and I think he'll be worried, because if they can't add significantly, I think they'll be really, really close to the drop next season.
Well, our friend XG says that that's exactly the case with Newcastle. They finish on 44 points, but expected points doesn't necessarily mean exactly what they should have had. I mean, just because they're expected points is 31.92. No, it doesn't mean they would have got 32 points. But the underlying stats in Newcastle suggest that they should have been way lower down the table and actually should probably have been bottom. So it's not ideal. But the thing is, they do, like, having players like Saint-Maximin, like, now he's started to realise that passing the ball is an option. They have players that can make a bit of a difference, but they rely on the counter-attack a lot. And things go in their way. But when that doesn't work out for them, they will, exactly what Matt's saying, they'll be in real trouble. And it's quite difficult. And underlying stats tend to level out over a couple of seasons, two or three seasons. So
There's a lot of talk about this particular group that wanted to buy them, basically. And them going might make it really difficult. But it doesn't matter, because there's loads of millionaires who all want to invest in football and they'll find another buyer. I don't know if they'll find another buyer who was willing to spend the kind of money that that group was willing to spend. And that's what I think, because there's obviously a lot of billionaires in the world, more than there should be. And a lot of them want to make even more money. And that's why they invest in football. But it's more like a cash cow situation. They're not really looking to sit there and just keep spending all the funds, unless, you know, they are like the Qatari ownership of PSG, or the ownership at Manchester City. So I feel like it's that's quite a loss on that, in the sense that I don't know how many next groups are going to come in. They'll buy the, they'll definitely be interested in the club. There's already apparently a talk coming from Italy that the ownership of Roma want to sell up and buy into Newcastle. I don't know if that's true or not, but I wonder how many will really come in and invest the kind of money that the fans were really hoping were going to come in.
The other thing that struck me was that, you know, this the Saudi takeover had been there for a while. I mean, they'd been interested for a while pre-COVID, and they were going through with it. While we're so uncertain about things, why would someone just come out from nowhere? I mean, you'd be buying a club where you don't know when your fans are going to let back in. How would you do the figures accurately?
It's not really about the football, right? I think that.
But you don't know how much money you can make out of a club at the moment. I mean,
I think this is the problem with
the worst. Unless Ashley's going to drop his price, it strikes me as the worst time to buy a football club ever.
I think, as in, you know, in matters that sort of involve Gulf nations, it's always a mix of what their real interest is in buying a club, and that's why I tell you that I think certain ownerships will be happy to continue spending, because it's not really just about the football. It's like a mix of, you know, how this helps them on an economic, on a diplomatic, a political, industrial, all these types of scales. And I think that's why they look into football, because it sort of, like, you know, makes your brand better, if you like. That's why you go for ownerships that are from some certain Gulf states. So I think that's why they didn't really care about anything. They just wanted to buy regardless of what was going on around the world.
What about Manchester United? Some interesting rumours doing the rounds for them. Seems like they're going to be patient in their approach for Jadon Sancho, but all being well, that one looks quite promising. And Raul Jimenez is one being linked slightly less authoritatively, but an interesting name nonetheless. Do both of those players fit in with what Solskjaer's trying to do there, JJ?
Yeah, definitely. They just need to improve with players who are better than what they've already got. You'd want players who can challenge for first team place. Sancho will certainly do that. I think Mason Greenwood is next level and will be one of the best players that United have for the next few years. Sancho plays the same position as him, but then I wonder whether Greenwood might actually end up being the central striker in future. Like, often is the case with younger players that they start them wide early in their career, so there's not so much pressure on them to deliver everything from the central point. But Greenwood can definitely do that, and he was, you know, he's a striker at youth level as well. Sancho will give them something, a really exciting player to watch. It's interesting, all the bits and pieces that have happened with him at Dortmund and various critiques of his character and attitudes that has been there, but obviously a really talented player, and Solskjaer would need to make sure that he gets everything out of him. Jimenez is a lovely striker and exactly the kind of player that I think United would suit right now. Really good link-up play, which is what the central striker needs to do, because Martial tends to be the one that, like, he likes to play off the shoulder of the last man when he's number nine. And I think Jimenez is better at maybe holding the ball and linking it, then arriving, whereas Martial's better if you're looking to try and hit on the counter and things like that. So it would definitely give them options as well.
We're interrupting this podcast to bring you news of another Telegraph show we think you might like. It's called Planet Normal, and it's hosted by me, Liam Halligan.
And me, Alison Pearson. We're both Telegraph columnists who share the view that far too often those who shout the loudest on the telly just don't represent the views of normal people.
So take a trip with us to Planet Normal. We're joined by some stellar guests, well-known voices from politics, business and the arts.
All from different fields, but they have one thing in common. They're at the top of their game, but distinctly down to earth. The good news is I finally learnt what a podcast is and even how you subscribe to it. It's actually quite simple. Search for Planet Normal on your podcast app or click on the link in the show notes for this episode.
You don't really know what a podcast is, do you?
I am one. Look, I am one. Who needs to know what it is? I am one, okay? Shut up.
Let's talk about the Championship playoff final, which takes place on Tuesday evening. It's Brentford and Fulham in West London's fourth best derby. Who do we think is going to win this football match?
I'm really, really looking forward to this. I watched the semi-final between Fulham and Cardiff the other night when Cardiff almost came back, and really enjoyed it. Fulham had a proper wobble, so if you were going off that, you'd fancy Brentford. But Fulham have got some know-how, haven't they? I mean, they've got a lot of players who were in that playoff final victory against Villa. They've got a lot of players who played in the Premier League for them and come down with them still. So I think they've got that bit of know-how that might get them over the line, actually. Brentford are the sort of more gung-ho. Brentford are like Fulham were almost 2 years ago, just very gung-ho, very exciting, very attacking. I fancy Fulham. I don't know why, but I fancy Fulham through the know-how, probably. But I think it'll be really interesting. I think whichever one goes up is going to go straight back down.
Every chance. Which team would you prefer to have in the Premier League? I know what you're going to say, Mina. I know you're basically a Fulham fan.
Yeah, basically, just because it'd be nice to have Craven Cottage as part of the Premier League again.
Yeah, but there's a lovely new stadium going up at Brentford.
That can't be that far from you.
That's not close to me, though, is it?
I mean, it must be fairly close if Fulham's close.
Yeah, I guess so, but Fulham's just closer. So I'm somebody who hates walking, right? So.
Right. Okay. How about you, JJ? Who do you want in the top four?
I would quite like to see Brentford in there. I like the way that they've their scouting recruitment is really interesting, and how they find players that are definitely capable of playing at a higher level. I think they're one of these teams that have taken a very Moneyball style approach to things over the last few seasons, and hence their kind of rise to where they are just now. They've got some great individual players. I went to see them play against QPR with you, Tom, didn't I? They had like Ben Rahama is a good player. Ollie Watkins seems like a really good player, but I'd imagine both of those will leave if they don't go up. Yeah, I'd like to see Brentford, because it's good to have a team like that who will utilise all this kind of modern data, and they'll sign some good players and we might see something special with it. I could see them even doing like a Wolves. They wouldn't have the same access to players that they did, but I could see them finishing okay next season if they were to get up.
When was this group outing to watch QPR?
Oh, it was cold.
I wasn't in it.
Yeah, I'm supposed to be your bestie.
I tell you what, when the football is back, when we can all go back, we'll have a lovely AFCT trip to Loftus Road, and the subpar pies are on me. On Friday evening, we have a return to European football with the Champions League. Woo-hoo! How are you feeling about this? Are you looking forward to this extremely unusual Champions League festival, or have you, like me, slightly lost faith in football as a thing that's going to particularly entertain you at the moment?
There's so much football. I think it'll be exciting, though. It's like when you play a Pro Evo or something with your mates and you get to do Real Madrid versus Man City and all those sorts of bits and pieces. It doesn't really feel like the Champions League because it's, to know, it's all a bit strange.
I think the mini tournament will be good. I think that'll be fun.
Yeah,
And if you lose, 16 and if your team loses.
Yeah, you're gone. I think that I really am actually quite looking forward to watching the mini tournament. I think that'll be good fun. The last 16, I couldn't be care less about, to be honest with you.
Don't you want to see Real Madrid or Manchester City? But.
Yes, I suppose I am interested to see if it's Real Madrid or Manchester City. I've got a work perspective on whereby I have to preview the Bayern Munich versus Chelsea second leg coming up.
Yeah, that one, and I can see why you don't give a. Yeah,
it's not really done much for my enthusiasm for the last 16. But I think the mini tournament will be great fun. I think it's bonkers in a way with, you know, the restart of. I know the European clubs who get to the mini tournament are going to get a delayed start to next season. But I do think it's mad that if Chelsea get knocked out on the 8th of August, that they still have to restart on the 12th of September. I mean, it's less than 5 weeks.
Yeah, but they'll play one game, right?
Yeah, like but they haven't, because their season, they had to prepare for the FA Cup final. So it's not like they've had a little break and then play one game. Their season's just carried on and on.
It's okay, they have like 400 forwards. They'll find a way.
I think it's a bit mad. It'll be interesting to see how long the clubs who get into the mini tournament get off. I think that's mad too. But it'd be fun. It'd be like a pre-season tournament in a way, wouldn't it?
Oh, the ICC.
I do think it's going to throw up an interesting new winner. I don't necessarily think it's going to be one of, you know, like, I don't necessarily basically think the best team's going to win it, which is why I think it could be a lot of fun, because it's going to be one of those like mad, you know, like anything can happen in 90 minute type of game. So
I think the Europa will be really interesting as well. I think Man United are going to win the Europa League. I think that'll be interesting.
Do you?
Yeah.
They're your favourites, are they, Matt?
Yeah, having taken no notice of who else is left in it.
That's what I was thinking.
Who else is in it? Inter Milan? Milan, who might not have Conte as manager by then, by the sounds of it. I don't know. I think both of them would be good fun.
Sevilla,
like,
who are very good at this competition. Shakhtar Donetsk.
There you go.
Roma.
All of those.
Wolves. Man United. That's what we all want to see.
I mean, I'd just like to see, you know, I don't know, no one complaining about the Club Rouge ball. That would be something.
Let's have a little bit of music and a song for Europe. Mina, Serie A, the only major European league still going, finished this weekend. Aside from your Juve, who were the biggest winners and the biggest losers this season?
It's interesting. Obviously, like, we thought this was going to be a different championship until Corona started, because at the time, Lazio were doing such a terrific job and there was a very real chance that they were going to topple Juve. Obviously, what you see after Corona was, you know, the teams that had the better depths, you know, the bigger teams, basically Inter and Juve being the ones that eventually did a lot better, and the ones that managed to sort of, you know, win the matches that they needed to, while Lazio could basically barely recuperate. I think when you look at this, you can see the foundations have been laid at Roma. I think Fonseca's a terrific coach. And with the little interesting spending and just, you know, in key areas, I think they could be a real force next season. Atalanta's Atalanta. I think they've established themselves as an amazing side going forward. And also showed a lot of maturity at the back. Napoli under Gattuso are a much more interesting team to watch now, because you just feel like they're good on the ball, they're good off the ball. They've sort of tired towards the end of it, but that makes a lot of sense. I'm so dying to see what they're going to do against Barcelona, because, I mean, there's two sides to them and I want to know who shows up, because if the good version of them shows up, this could be a really thrilling game. So I think when you look forward, when you're looking at this team and you're looking how much Juve has sort of really not that great under Sarri, it will make for a lot more excitement going forward. And of course, there's always Inter under Antonio Conte, which is dramatic, even if they don't even kick a ball.
Yeah, well, some discussions around this morning that Conte may be on the way out there, despite only finishing atop a point off Juve on top of the table.
Yeah, we need to put that into context. Basically, they did. They basically lost every big game this season, I think, except for Napoli. They haven't really done it against the big teams, and that was always the criticism aimed at Antonio Conte. And obviously, what he did in the Champions League was considered an embarrassment, considering Italian teams did so well, and his side that had such an investment, 180 million plus, couldn't really, you know, put it together in the group stage. Anyway, so there's been criticism aimed at him, but there's also been a lot of compliments aimed at him. And him being his usual self, he's annoyed that he's not getting every single demand satisfied. And he's come out and said, you know, when I've been criticized, no one has protected me from this club. No one has turned around to really tell us that the work that we're doing is extraordinary. Firstly, it's good work. It's not extraordinary. Your team is so much bigger and better than most of what Serie A has. You've spent so much money on this. And considering what Spalletti had and the problems that he had last year, in the sense that Icardi went off the boil, there was arguments all over the dressing room, Nangolan was injured, he basically didn't have a team and he finished 13 points worse off. It's not a huge step forward, I'll be honest, you know. And most of your points were collected in these last few games when everyone is dead and buried and Juve don't care anymore, and so do a lot of sides. So I just feel like basically what he wants is, if he says a name, like, I want Romelu Lukaku, he doesn't want to fight for it. He just wants them to bring him, Romelu Lukaku. And you know, that was done. And he said that he had to go through hell to get it, basically. And now it'll be interesting to see, because he said this rant is not about transfer market, but you know it is, because that's what it ended up being when it came to Juventus. And Capello warned him at the time when he left Juve that you're not going to find, and you're not going to find it at Chelsea, you're not going to find a club that just supports you from beginning to end, or offers you what Juventus did at the time, because you were their captain more than you were just their coach. You were a former player. And he was like, nope, I'm going to do this. I'm going to find love everywhere else. I'm going to see, you're going to see how much people respect me. And you know what? He's never gone to a club that's going to offer him everything, because I don't know what he thinks he's doing. He's not doing Pep Guardiola-style football. He's not winning the big matches. So things take time. And you've got Marotta, and you've got a good ownership, and you've got a team that's willing to spend money on the targets that you want, some of which are just ridiculous. And so, you know, just stick with it. Maybe stop talking. If he just stopped talking, I really feel like Inter could be such a force. But he keeps doing this, and then he keeps ruining it for himself.
Yep, he's a man keen on falling out with other people, isn't he? Let's finish off by asking this question, which we put to our friends on social media. Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang dropped the FA Cup before lifting it on Saturday. We asked, what's the clumsiest thing you've ever seen from a professional footballer? Neil and many others got this question right, I think, by saying Tony Adams dropping Steve Morrow after winning the League Cup. That was extremely funny for everyone except Steve Morrow. Jamie says, Ivanovic drops the Russian Cup, which is made out of glass, which isn't ideal. And Matt, not Matt Law, says, I saw Roy Hodgson sign Paul Konchesky. What do you think, JJ?
I think the obvious one for me was when Sergio Ramos dropped the trophy off the top of the bus for Real Madrid. The Champions League trophy.
That's my one.
That was funny. And it doesn't, I don't think this really counts, but like it just reminded me of like silly things that happened to footballers, maybe not being careful. And I don't know if anyone remembers a story from 10 years ago where the then Rangers defender Kirk Broadfoot suffered burns after an egg exploded in his face. The newspaper headline, is the story of it is really funny. They all use the same copy. But it talks about how Kirk Broadfoot suffered burns. The manager's confirmed it today. It says the Scotland defender was inspecting two eggs he had just poached in his microwave when one of them blew up. Why is he inspecting eggs? I don't understand what the inspecting bit is. Bad injury, though.
Yeah.
You don't expect that. You can't see that
egg on his face. Go on, give us a bit more on Ramos, Mina. Talk us through that incident.
Oh, no. Well, it was just at the time they'd won the Copa del Rey over Barcelona and they won their way to Cibeles, which is where they party with all their fans. And basically, he dropped it in front of the moving bus and went, the cup has fallen. And at the time, they were like, you know, El Mundo came out and said, oh, my God, the cup was in 10 different pieces. Whereas others were like, no, it's all right, you know. But I think that was quite funny because all you could see was the entire team that was supposed to be celebrating were peering over the edge of the bus to see their cup being trodden over by the tires of the bus. I loved it.
What do you reckon, Matt?
I thought I'd been really clever by lining up the Ivanovic question. I didn't think
the
Ivanovic answer. I watched that on social media last week.
Jamie stole your...
It's killed me. It's absolutely killed me, yeah. I don't know
now. Dropped a remote control on his foot. Who was that? That was a good one. Someone dropped their
remote control. A few fallen downstairs as well. But, you know, it's killed me. I had the Ivanovic. So whoever that is banned from listening to this podcast in future. Who is it? Who is
Jamie.
It? Jamie, you're banned.
That's all from us for a while. Thank you very much to everyone that's appeared on this podcast this extended season and indeed for the past 3 years in its various guises. Mina, JJ and Matt especially, but not forgetting the supporting cast. Sam Dean, Jim White, Jason Burt, Luke Edwards, James Ducker, Sam Wallace, Chris Bascom, Jamie Carragher. The list goes on for some time. You can read their world-beating football coverage at telegraph.co.uk/sport and you don't even need to be a subscriber to the full Telegraph package to read them. It's just £2 a week for a sport-only subscription. Extra large thanks to our two producers, Joel Grove and his predecessor, Abby Patterson, both absolute heroes whose hard work has powered Audio Football Club. Thanks too to Theodora Leloudis, the Telegraph's superb podcast editor, and her predecessor, Pete Norton, for all their brilliance. You can, as ever, contact me on Twitter, @Tom_Gibbs. Thanks again to Joel for this episode, and of course, thanks to you, most of all, for your company. I'll talk to you again soon.